It looks like everyone's here. Good morning, everyone, to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. We're ready to begin the second case on the calendar. That is court file A20 0032, Gehring Properties et al. Appellants versus Martin Gehring et al. Respondent. Just a couple of comments. I'm sure you're aware that each party here will have 15 minutes for your principal arguments, and then appellant counsel for appellant will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. Since these arguments are also available to the public live here, I also remind everyone that pursuant to the court rules, an independent recording of these proceedings is prohibited by court rule. The court is making a recording of the proceedings, and we will post it on our website in our normal course of business. So with that, if everyone can hear me fine, we'll begin. Counsel for appellant, or both counsel, if you'll identify yourselves for our record, please, as you begin your arguments. Otherwise, at this point, counsel for appellant, you may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, my name is Jason Steck, S-T-E-C-K. I'm counsel for the appellants at Gehring Properties and Quality Car Wash. I'll refer to them collectively as the companies. Gehring's Car Wash is a multi-generational family legacy, and it's threatened with extinction by an unjustifiable dissolution order and an unjustified and excessive attorney's fees award. The dissolution order here is unjustified on three grounds. First, the court erred by finding that Marty and Lori Ann Gehring, the respondents, and I'll refer to them as Marty and Lori Ann because everybody's last name in this is Gehring, so we usually refer to them as by their first names. The court erred by finding that Marty and Lori Ann were oppressed shareholders. Second, because the court designed a buyout process that was designed to fail. It was simply impossible to meet. Third, dissolution was unwarranted when the district court ultimately decided that that was the remedy. I'll begin by discussing how Marty and Lori Ann were not oppressed shareholders.
Can I ask you this? What is our standard of for review for these matters that you've raised?
Overall, the standard of review is an abuse of discretion. The statute in question here grants the court what has been termed wide discretion. And what I'd emphasize, however, is that wide discretion is not unbounded discretion. It is still bounded by the requirements of the statutes and the case law that have addressed these sorts of matters. And the court repeatedly here simply ignored the requirements of the statute and the case law.
And is so the issue of whether your clients were oppressed or not, or the issue of, excuse me, of whether the shareholders were oppressed or not, I guess it'd be the respondents. Is that a factual issue? Is there a legal issue?
It's a mixed question of law and fact. Certainly the factual issues underlying it would be addressed for clear error, but the application of the standards of what constitutes an oppressed shareholder, that's a legal question.
All right. Are you disputing any of the underlying facts?
No, I'm fully, with the exception of the valuation question, which is reviewed for clear error, and that comes later. With the exception of that, we're completely aware of the court's standard of review with regard to credibility questions. We're not asking the court to revisit the credibility determinations made by the district court. We are asking the court to revisit the application of the law to those facts.
All right.
In that regard, then, Mr. Steck, irregardless of the court's findings on the shareholder oppression or unfairly prejudicial conduct issue, the parties do not seem to take issue with the court's finding that there was a shareholder deadlock here, which under the statute would allow for equitable relief. So, why is there so much concentration put on shareholder oppression when there's no dispute that there was a shareholder deadlock?
Because the form that equitable relief would take relies on the equities of the matter. So therefore, whether or not the shareholders were oppressed, as is repeatedly emphasized by both respondents and the district court, feeds into the decision on whether or not we need to go to dissolution and what form the buyout needs to take. So the equities are relevant to the form of equitable relief, not, if not to the existence of equitable relief.
Well, didn't you agree on the trial level that equitable relief was necessary because of deadlock?
Yes, Your Honor, but we also emphasized throughout, we wanted a buyout. The respondents are right about that. We asked for a buyout, but we wanted a buyout that was fair and equitable. And our contention is, first of all, that because Marty and Lorianne were terminated for cause, many of their claims of, well, we deserve more or our form of a buyout are unjustified, because that feeds in, that question feeds into what form the equitable buyout take. But more importantly, the fact that the buyout that was demanded by the respondents and imposed by the district court was flatly impossible to meet renders it unfair and inequitable. It can't be said to be an equitable or fair buyout if it's impossible for it to happen. And there's no company I can think of existing in the world that could come up with the cash value of 50% of its gross value within 60 days. That's simply impossible. And so that can't be said to be a fair and equitable buyout. The statute says that when there is a buyout, it has to take place on fair and equitable terms, which means that there's two components that have to be fair and equitable. The valuation has to be fair and equitable, and the terms, in other words, the payment terms, the way that the value is paid out, has to also be fair and equitable. And in this case, neither of those two were fair and equitable. There's the valuation issue, and then there is the terms issue. On the issue of valuation, we concede that this is a factual question, so it's reviewed for clear error. But this standard is met here, because taking on its own terms, without reference to Mr. Peterson's testimony or any evidence proffered by the appellants other than the documents expressly relied upon by the court's valuation expert, the court or the valuator exaggerated the value of the companies. And it did so by taking a document that laid out two different scenarios, one where the companies were being valued as just the real estate, and another where the companies were being valued as a car wash. In other words, the use of the real estate as a car wash and as a going concern. It found that using this property as a car wash was a less valuable use of the property. This is the Nagel appraisal. So it said that the best use of this property would be to tear it down and build an office building there. This is a location in Wayzata where there is an interest in land to be used for office space. So the best use of it would be to sell it and use it for redevelopment. And the value for that was $2 million. So that's the real estate value. If used as a less valuable car wash, the combined valuation would be about the same, because the real estate's being used for a less valuable purpose. The going concern added on top still results in about $2 million. What Mr. Berning here did, though, is he said, I'm going to take that real estate valuation that assumes that we're not going to use it as a car wash, and I'm going to count that as $2 million of value. And then I'm going to add on a going concern valuation of $1 million, of $1.1 million, which is expressly excluded by the $2 million valuation that he's relying upon. That's clear error. That is a valuation which double counts the value of the going concern. Because that same valuation that he's relying on, saying that if it's used as a less valuation as a car wash, if you include the going value concern, you get the $2 million there as well. And then he adds $1.1 million on top for the going valuation concern.
But the court heard testimony from both Mr. Fleming and Mr. Berning that that wasn't double counting. The only contrary evidence was Mr. Peterson, who admitted he has no valuation expertise. So how could that be a clearly erroneous finding by the court to rely on that evidence in the record?
Because I'm asking the court to look at not Mr. Peterson's testimony, but the documents that the valuator said he was relying on, which said this is only a $2 million real estate value if it's not used as a car wash. He adopts that finding and then says, I'm going to add on to $1 million because it's being used as a car wash. An add-on that is expressly precluded by his own adoption of the $2 million real estate.
Well, so are you essentially arguing it's an either or situation? You either do it as a real estate matter or as a business matter?
I'm saying that the Nagel appraisal, which Mr. Berning said he was adopting, lays out that either or scenario.
But you know, I mean, I guess this gets into some an area that would require some expertise from whoever's doing the evaluation. I mean, if can't you in fact have a business that may go 10, 20 years down the road, and then they still have value in that property if they want to sell it?
Sure, but that's not what happened.
So, I mean, don't you have to consider both? Because that real estate value doesn't go away. I mean, it's always there.
But this is a valuation date was set by the court in 2016. We're not looking 10 to 20 years down the road.
I understand that. But there is value in that real estate, no matter what happens to the business. Right.
Sure. And that's what the Nagel appraisal that Mr. Berning adopted said was $2 million, period, if used for redevelopment.
Right.
But I'm
just trying to understand your argument that this is a double counting because you have both things going on, even as of the date of the evaluation, right? You have the option to have an ongoing business, plus you have real estate that's worth $2 million.
Right. And the Nagel appraisal looked at that option and said, look, no, the real estate's only worth $2 million on that valuation date if it is torn down on that date and reused for redevelopment. It has a lesser value if it's continued to be used as a car wash. And that's where the double counting comes in, because that lesser value, if you then add on the valuation date, the value of the going concern comes to also to approximately $2 million. And then Mr. Berning added on another counting of the going concern value. He counted it twice. By adopting a valuation that said it's worth $2 million and then adding on again a piece of that same valuation. But I'd like to also address the fact that the buyout terms were unreasonable. In addition to double counting on the valuation, The requested buyout still has to be fair and equitable. And it's simply, there's not one iota of evidence that respondents have ever presented to the district court or to this court in their briefing that it is possible for a company to come up with 50% of its gross valuation in cash in 60 days. That can't be said to be a fair and equitable buyout process if it's flatly impossible. Respondents or appellants contended throughout that this is impossible. We can't do this. We asked to adopt the valuation to adjust for this and to apply Follett to adjust for this. And both of those requests were ignored. So this isn't the remedy that the appellants requested. It's a different remedy that was imposed on the appellants that simply fits in the general category of buyout, but takes a fundamentally unfair in inequitable form, because it's impossible. Something that's impossible can't be said to be equitable. And that's where
was there any other proposal that you believe that would have been equitable?
I mean, repeatedly.
That was presented to the judge?
Yes, Your Honor. We repeatedly presented to the judge alternatives that we would pay this over time so that the companies would be able to pay over time. We would also consider a mixed solution where we would pay a chunk of a buyout in cash up front, but would then pay the remainder over time. We suggested also that that Marty and Lori Ann could retain their stock in the companies during the buyout process as security on their claim, so that they would then be able to, if the payments weren't made or something like that, they could foreclose on their on their note and be able to recover it that way. We presented the court with numerous options.
And what is your understanding as to why the court rejected that?
It simply said Follett doesn't apply because you asked for this remedy. And nothing in Follett says that. Nothing in Follett says that it matters or it changes it because you asked for this remedy. Respondents have also said that, well, Follett is distinguishable because this is a case of 50-50 ownership. Follett doesn't say that either. It simply says that if a buyout terms would cripple the company financially, and certainly something that's impossible to meet and leads to dissolution meets that standard, then extraordinary circumstances exist justifying the application of a marketability discount. Fundamentally, what's happened here is that the court has made a rush to dissolution. The court has said, originally in its original order that dissolution would be unjust to the remaining shareholders. It never changed that finding. It never said, well, now it's just and here's why. Those remaining shareholders, which include a 10-year-old girl, haven't done anything wrong here. But the court, after an impossible buyout process was not met, simply said, okay, we're going to dissolution. You haven't made the buyout, we're going to go to dissolution. Somehow, what was unjust then became acceptable with no further findings. And so for those reasons, we'd ask that the dissolution order be reversed and the matter remanded.
And you will have 5 minutes of rebuttal if you wish, Mr. Steck. Mr. Cross, you may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. If it may please the court and counsel, my name is Dustin Cross. I represent Marty and Lori Ann Gehring. I'd like to just kind of respond to some of the comments made by Mr. Steck regarding the buyout and the impossibility argument. He's presented no evidence of that. He simply says it. I am familiar with, for instance, auctions, significantly higher dollar value auctions where a down payment of 10% is made with closing to occur within 30 days. I am aware of bankruptcy auctions where entire businesses, even publicly traded businesses, close within 30 to 60 days. So the idea that Mr. Steck's unvarnished argument that it was impossible doesn't really hold water. There's no evidence to support it. Moreover, it is exactly the remedy that they were looking for. My clients own 50% of this company. My client worked, Marty Gehring worked at the company basically right out of college and has worked there for many years. He has.
What about this argument that they can't do it in 60 days, but they could have done a payment over time? I mean, yes. Why didn't the judge do that?
Because the proposal was for, I believe, 7 to 10 years amortization, secured by non-voting. Mr. Steck elided over that comment. The stock that was supposed to secure this buyout was going to be stripped of its voting rights. And so we were left with a situation where over 7 to 10 years, we were supposed to wait around and hope that Mr. Stephen Gehring doesn't run the company into the ground, which led to all of this litigation. So we believe and have believed that the best way to find the highest and best value isn't to rely on appraisers, isn't to rely on experts, but instead is to actually have an auction amongst the family members to find the best value. And in each side, 50% shareholders, why should I have to be the seller? We lost on that issue. We did not appeal it, we lost. We accepted the proposal or the court's decision to hire a special master, Mr. Fleming, the special master, was consented to and agreed upon by both parties. He, after consulting with both parties, agreed to hire Mr. Burning. Mr. Burning issued his opinion. Mr. Steck had the opportunity and did argue his case before Mr. Fleming. He then lost that issue before Mr. Fleming, arguing this double counting issue. He then insisted on and was given the opportunity to have a evidentiary hearing, which was held in August of 2019. The special master's report was issued in May of 2019. And ultimately, the court did not enter its order adopting the special master's recommendations until September. So if you start, if you really go back to May, when he knew that there was, and his clients knew there was a decent chance that they would be required to, if they wanted to buy the company, that they should begin the process of arranging financing. They had far more than 60 days to begin that process. Instead, what they did is they wait until the last minute, and then they ask for a stay. They ask for a continuance. They ask for an evidentiary hearing. They don't want to get to the verb. And that's what we faced over and over and over again. And so in our view, we should have been given an equal right to buy the company. And if they could outbid us, they could. If we could outbid them, we could. The court did not agree with that. Now, on this double counting issue, the fact of the matter is that Mr. Steck and his clients called, I believe, and they called Mr. Peterson, a CPA, who admitted he had no expertise in business valuations, no certification, no experience in doing that. I don't believe Mr. Peterson's name even appears in the principal brief of the appellants. But the fact of the matter is, Mr. Burning testified, Mr. Fleming testified, and they explained to the court, and it's in the record, as to why this is not a double counting. And it's very simple. Judge Hooten, I believe you alluded to it. The fact of the matter is, the Nagel appraisal was a real estate land appraisal performed by an appraiser to secure collateral for a loan. And the bank isn't going to run a car wash. The bank, if they had to foreclose on this loan, the bank is going to turn around and sell it to the highest bidder, and they're going to be buying it as a defunct piece of essentially bare ground. But the land, okay, so the land has, in his opinion, supported the debt, but it did not. He did not do any significant analysis. I don't believe Quality Car Wash, that name, the operating entity, even appears in the appraisal whatsoever, the Nagel appraisal. Mr. Steck had the opportunity to call Mr. Nagel. He did not do it. So he's relying on a line from an appraisal that Mr. Burning referenced in his independent assessment of the value of the companies. And that's the job he was given. It is a factual decision, and there's no contrary evidence whatsoever. So we strongly believe, Your Honor, that the fact of the matter is simple. The court gave Stephen Gehring's and his children's side the opportunity to do exactly what it was they wanted to do, and they did not do it. And so now we're in a situation where almost a year later, we're probably going to be in the same situation that I wanted a year ago, which was to give everybody a fair and equal chance to buy out the other side. Everybody agrees, as Judge Flory has alluded to, everybody agrees that the equitable authorities of the court were triggered. Everyone agrees that this situation cannot occur or cannot continue indefinitely, and it needs to get resolved by one side buying out the other, or the company as a whole being sold to a third
party. How do you respond to Mr. Steck's argument that that in this case the district court had to make additional findings before going to what I think would be a complete dissolution of the company?
Well, I think that the court made detailed findings, Judge Hooten, and more importantly, the judge gave them what I believe to be a fair and reasonable opportunity to obtain the remedy that they were seeking, which is to buy us out at fair value. They chose not to do that and now complain, well, it was unreasonable. Well, they had at least, as I said, probably if the clock started running on September 24th, that would go to November 24th. They knew since May, the special master's report, that there was a good chance that the court would adopt this Mr. Fleming's report, because Mr. Fleming's report is, I think, self-contained, makes sense, and explains the basis on which he made the recommendations that he did to the court. So they had plenty of time. They had 6 months to arrange for whatever financing they arranged for. They just don't want to pay. They don't want to pay that big a bill, is what the reality is. And you saw that in their motion for a stay from about a week and a half ago, where they alluded to the changes in the economic circumstances due to COVID and other changes. Well, those are changes that are occurring today But the valuation goes back to 2016. They didn't challenge the valuation date. The valuation date was back to the date of the complaint, which the statute says absent other circumstances. And as the district court found, no one suggested an alternative date. No one suggested that any other date was appropriate, and it's not being appealed. So in our view, Your Honor, they were given exactly the relief, an opportunity to exercise the relief that they themselves wanted. And they chose not to do it. Maybe they can't do it. I don't know. But what I do know is that the court fashioned an overall remedy to say, okay, here's step one, this opportunity for Mr. Steck's clients to buy out my clients. Step two, if you don't do that, then we have to go to another process. And again, we are 50% shareholders. You know, there's no reason we shouldn't have been given the opportunity to buy. And I guarantee you, if we had been given that opportunity, we would have been able to increase the value returned to the shareholders over and above what we believe to be the only amounts that Mr. Steck's clients have been willing to pay. And so we would have increased the value. So in our view, the equitable, you know, the statute is pretty clear that it's abuse of discretion, and that the court, as Mr. Steck correctly alludes to, the district court has wide discretion because these things can take all forms. And I think the district courts need to have the flexibility after having heard interminable. We had, I believe, a 4-day evidentiary hearing on the primary case. We then had a 1-day evidentiary hearing on the valuation issue. So we've had 5 days of testimony. And the court, I think quite correctly, weighed the evidence, made detailed findings of fact, and fashioned a remedy that was suitable to the occasion. And so for the Court of Appeals to then kind of second guess that is really going to be ignoring the standard of review. So
let me ask you this, Mr. Cross, I'd like sure. to move on to the issue of attorney's fees, because Mr. Steck indicated in his initial comments that that's an issue he wanted to address, and you won't have a chance to respond to his rebuttal. So I'd be interested in your thoughts. It's, you know, in reading the briefs on this and looking at the, you know, extreme dysfunction in this family and the running of these companies, it seems to me that neither party came into this issue with total clean hands. Marty and Lori disregarded, as the district court judge found, orders to leave the tip money alone, orders to turn over the life insurance policy. And the court found that those are grounds for termination. However, the court found that it was outweighed by their primary reasons, as the court found it, for the termination. So I'm just wondering what, you know, and I know you've addressed this in your brief, but, you know, and looking at the equities from both sides here, how did the court not abuse its discretion in awarding attorney's fees to your clients here?
Well, a couple of comments, Your Honor. First, you have to recall that my clients, in essence, are paying half of the attorney's fees of Mr. Steck, because we own half the companies, and Mr. Steck is purporting to represent the companies, not the shareholders. So he's already paying half of those attorney's fees over and above his own independent attorney's fees. The second part is, when you say orders, Your Honor, with all due respect, what you're referring to are supposed directives, alleged directives that were challenged to some extent by the so-called board of directors. They were not court orders. The court's decision was based on, you know, in July of 2017, the court made perfectly clear that whatever informalities existed with the operation of the corporation to date, that it, because of the litigation, because of the litigious nature and relationship between the parties, the corporate formalities needed to be followed. Despite that, they weren't. So when we're talking about who's ignoring whose court orders, Mr. Stephen Gehring is the one who is ignoring the court's orders. Same true for production of financial information and documentary evidence. They keep on referring to claiming that my clients supposedly had that information at their house and they did not have access to it. The court did not accept that allegation and found that their actions significantly added to the cost of this litigation. And that is, I think, well within the court's discretion to make those determinations that throughout the case and to balance the equities, quite frankly, given the fact that we are already paying half of the so-called company's attorney fees, and they've hired all kinds of experts. They've had Mr. Jeff Bonner. They've had this Mr. Monroe, who I think filed some type of affidavit along with the motion for stay. They've hired all of these people, none of them with board approval, by the way, and increased costs significantly because of their delays that the court found. So I think it was well within the court's discretion. The idea that you can parse out the amount of time spent dealing with the violations of court orders and the refusal to produce documents as between that and the other portions of the litigation is impossible. And I think that's why the Musicland case recognizes that in cases such as this, where a portion of the case it justifies attorney's fees and a portion may not, that the courts recognize that they're inextricably intertwined and you cannot expect or demand that they be separately parsed out. And so the court, I think quite appropriately, looked at the case, looked at and made detailed findings and determined a suitable percentage that she decided was appropriate in these circumstances. And
I just have one follow-up on that. It seems like the basis for awarding attorney's fees for the bad faith had to do with the issues involving the stock transfer to Lori, getting Martin out of the business so that he couldn't interfere with business decisions, and the allegations of stealing or taking tip money and undue compensation. Is there support in the record in 1 minute or less to support that was 70% of this litigation to justify an award of 70% of the attorney's fees?
Well, I think that it wasn't just, I don't think you can pigeonhole the award of attorney's fees based on those limited specific acts, Your Honor. I think that the court made a determination that the actions and conduct of the companies as run by Stephen Gehring were in fact contributing significantly to the overall cost of the litigation. And that's, I think, the basis for her decision to award attorney's fees.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Cross.
Thank you.
Mr. Steck, you do have 5 minutes of rebuttal. You're muted, Mr. Steck.
You know, you'd think I'd have learned by now. Your Honor, I'd like to begin with Mr. Cross's comment that there was no evidence offered that it was impossible to comply with a 60-day buyout for 50% of the gross value of the companies in cash. That's false. It is in the record. There's testimony at the evidentiary hearing by Stephen Gehring, who is president of one of the companies and vice president of the other, who said that when he got the valuation and the order that it be paid within 60 days, he did an analysis of the company's finances and flatly said, we can't do it. We can't do that. And we don't think we could ever do that because we don't think we could ever find financing that makes it possible to pony up 50% of the gross value of the companies. 50%, not net, gross. Gross value of the companies in 60 days.
But the district court rejected that. Why isn't that a credibility finding that we give deference to?
The district court didn't expressly reject it. It didn't address it at all. It didn't say, the district court, no finding can be found in any court order in this case that said, I find that it is possible to do this. The court never made that finding. It simply said it didn't care. This is what I'm ordering. That's not a credibility determination. That's just ignoring the issue. And the issue is that it cannot be said to be fair and equitable when it's impossible. Even Mr. Cross acknowledges, maybe they can't do it. That's correct. They can't do it. They cannot come up with 50% of the gross value of the companies in 60 days. Can't be done. Now, with regard to the Nagel appraisal, I just note again to emphasize that We're not asking the court to question Mr. Berning's expertise or his credibility, merely to read the documents that Berning himself cites. And that is, the Nagel appraisal says that the $2 million real estate valuation that Mr. Berning adopts is expressly conditioned on it not being used as a car wash. He then adds on a value for it being used as a car wash. Those are incompatible, and that's clear error. Now, with regard to the attorney's fees issue, I'd first note that the Music Land case is clearly inapplicable here. Music Land involved a case where there were two theories of relief arising from the exact same conduct, one of which was successful, one of which was not. The attorney's fees reward was inextricably intertwined because we simply couldn't identify different conduct to separate out the issues. In this case, it's entirely different. The conduct that would form the basis for the court's attorney's fees award was discrete and distinct in time and place and by the persons allegedly doing it. It is possible to parse the records. The respondents didn't want to do it. They didn't want to go through the trouble. They didn't want to stop their practice of block billing. They didn't want to stop their practice of double billing for two attorneys doing duplicate work. They didn't want to do the work. And the court said outright in its own comments that the court didn't like doing this kind of work. It doesn't like going through attorney's fees. And that's why the court directed the respondents to parse their attorney's fees records. The respondents refused to do so, and then the court decided that it wasn't going to enforce its own rules. That's an improper process. But also, it's substantially unjustified because the court based the majority of its attorney's fees award on the allegation that the companies had pursued excessive compensation and tip claims without any evidence whatsoever. Now, we do concede that that's a factual determination. There was no evidence existing for you to pursue this with. So that can be reviewed for clear error. Was there any evidence existing to support that? There was. There was evidence existing of bad of excessive compensation, but that was excluded. Companies complied with that exclusion of the evidence, but it doesn't mean the evidence didn't exist. It did exist. It was just excluded. So it's not bad faith to pursue it on that basis.
Can I get back to, you know, this this finding or this holding of the court regarding the Mr. Steck, can you hear me? It'll help. Can you hear me now, Mr. Steck? Okay. Should I re-ask the question?
Yes, Your Honor. I didn't hear any of the questions.
Did you hear any part of the question? Okay. I'll try again then. Because, you know, I think you're complaining that this valuation was too high. And in determining whether the court abused its discretion in ordering the equitable remedy, I think we have to look at that evaluation. I mean, doesn't that evaluation of the worth of the company actually help your clients? Because if they get outbid on this, they're going to get more money, right? Because of this valuation.
Well, Your Honor, the valuation that was used by the special master has absolutely no relationship to what would happen in a dissolution sale.
Well, except your clients are going to be able to effectively argue that it's worth a lot more if someone's bidding for it, right?
Well, it's not a process where we're going to be able to argue. And also, to Mr. Cross's point, that we're not even going to be able to bid in it because the assets of the companies, it would be an open auction. There's no basis for getting to argue to people how much this is worth. The marketplace would just decide on its own, not with reference to anything that's happened before. And with regard to Mr. Cross's point about the companies could just bid on themselves. No, they couldn't. The companies would be in receivership. The property of the companies would be owned by the receiver. We wouldn't be able to use that property to make any bids at all. We wouldn't own it at the time of the dissolution sale.
All
All right. Well, we're well over the time. There was some tough technical difficulties, and I've given you additional time to address those questions, Mr. Steck, because it seemed like the fair thing to do. But our time is up now, and the court has the matter that's been well briefed by both sides here, and we appreciate your arguments today. But we will take the matter under advisement at this time, and we will have a decision issued within 90 days of today's date.